climbed into bed and flipped off the light on the end table next to her. Seconds later, she began to cry.
Are you fucking serious?
Court Gentry knelt just 20 feet away, watching the woman through a slat between two louvers in the door of the linen closet, a thin sheet of sweat glistening in the thin shaft of moonlight running across his forehead. He'd removed the lower shelf in the closet so he could fit there on his knees, and then he'd pushed back tight into the small and dark space and covered his body with a pair of large pillows. And he was glad he'd done so, because when his target had opened the door to grab the extra blanket, he'd been able to remain tucked under the middle shelf and out of her view. He looked forward to being able to stand again, to straighten his legs, but his plan had been to give his target time to fall asleep before moving on her. But now she was crying for some reason, and Court worried it would take her a while to nod off. He looked down to his watch. Its hour and minute hands were tipped with vials of tritium gas, so they would show faintly, even in complete darkness. He told himself he could wait a half hour, but then he'd need to act, whether or not she was asleep. Court was dressed head to toe in black, and he wore a small black pack on his back, staged with rappelling gear. A suppressed Glock 19 snapped into an open-style molded polymer holster on his hip, and a pair of flashbang grenades on his Kevlar vest. A black Benchmade Infidel switchblade was hooked into his back pocket, smoke grenades and a fixed blade knife hung in sheaths on his utility belt, and another blade was hooked into one of his black Merrell boots. He had a plan tonight, and he'd prepped accordingly, perhaps even over-preparing with all the gear on his body. But Court had learned through hard experience that out here in the field, he could rely on no one but himself, so everything he might possibly require on an operation, he needed to have within reach before the onset of action. Court had been trained by the CIA, specifically by a grizzled Vietnam veteran he knew as Maurice, and Maurice had a saying that played back in Court's brain at times like this.
Son, you can never have too much ammo unless you're drowning or on fire.
Court had laughed the first time Maurice said it, but he quit laughing the first time the saying had saved his life. Bianca Medina's crying intensified for a few minutes, then softened to sobs, and eventually even that drifted away. Court didn't know what she was upset about, and he didn't really care, except for the fact that he wanted her to hurry up and fall asleep so he could get on with his night. The last thing he needed was her calling out to her gorillas when he crossed the room towards her. Soon, Medina rolled onto her side, facing Court's direction. The blinds were open on the French doors out to the balcony, and faint moonlight from outside reached into the room and illuminated her face. Even from across the master bedroom, the man in the closet could see that the woman's eyes were open and wet.
Count sheep, lady. I don't have all damn night.
To his pleasure, soon her eyes closed and remained so. He watched the cadence of her breathing slow finally, and he knew she was out or close to it. After another check of his watch, he told himself he'd move in 5 minutes. Just then, the shafts of moonlight on Bianca Medina's face altered, and Court leaned to his left to try to get a look outside on the balcony. He didn't have much room to maneuver where he knelt, but by pressing his head all the way against the wall, he could see what had interrupted the light. He blinked hard in surprise. One of Medina's bodyguards stood on the balcony just outside the window, staring through the glass at the woman lying in bed. Court knew the layout of this property because he'd had the run of the place for much of the time the entourage was out to dinner. He'd come down from the roof of an adjacent building full of retail spaces, and he'd dropped onto the balcony where the guard now stood. There was no real access from any other part of the building, which meant the bodyguard must have climbed out the window of the other bedroom in the suite and scooted along a foot-wide ledge to make his way to the balcony.
What the hell? Court wondered. Does this guy really have orders to watch his protectee sleep?
The woman seemed to have no idea he was there, or else she was so accustomed to being watched over like this that it no longer bothered her at all. Or else, and Court imagined this to be a distinct possibility, it did bother her, and that was why she cried herself to sleep. Court almost felt sorry for her for a moment. Almost. The arrival of the close protection agent on the balcony complicated the situation exponentially. Court had a Gemtech suppressor on his Glock pistol, but shooting this asshole was still going to make a hell of a lot of noise. The men in other parts of the suite would all hear it, and they'd come hard and fast in the protection of their client. He decided he'd watch the guard for a few minutes to see if he'd leave, or at least turn away. But if the man remained there, focused on Bianca Medina through the glass door of the balcony, Court would just have to deal with the sentry before carrying on with his mission, because it looked like there was no way he was getting to the girl without the man seeing him. There was little automobile traffic in the 8th arrondissement at this time of night. The area was all but deserted, but a single man on a bicycle rolled along the Rue Tronchet, passing the Madeleine Church. A few seconds later, a second bicycle appeared from the north, and a third turned onto the street from the west just after that. All three cyclists slowed when they came to a point just south of the big red double doors closing off the forecourt of the Hotel Particulier. Two of the men climbed off their bikes and stepped up to the wall just feet from the doorway, while the third dropped his kickstand and parked directly under the security camera, pointing down to the pavement in front of the doorway. He deftly climbed up onto his bike, put one foot on the top tube and another on the seat, and used the wall of the building and his left hand to balance himself there. With his right hand, he pulled a can of black spray paint from the pocket of his hoodie. He shook the can a couple of times, then sprayed up from below, coating the lens of the camera black in an instant. The two others watched him work, and as soon as he was finished, they rushed forward, knelt at the door latch, and pulled out their lock-picking tools. One man centered a flashlight's beam on the lock while the other worked. And while this was going on, the man on the bike jumped down, pulled out his phone, and speed dialed a number. He stood there looking up and down the street, ready to warn the lockpicking team of any passers-by on the sidewalks or vehicles on the road. He did see one vehicle almost immediately, but he did not caution his mates. A black work van, with its lights extinguished, rolled slowly into view on the far side of the Madeleine Church to the south, some 100 meters away, and it stopped there. Into his phone, the lookout whispered,
"Je te vois."
I see you. Behind him, he heard a soft click as the lockpicker finished his work. The man pushed down on the latch slowly and softly, so as to avoid any echoes in the cobblestoned forecourt on the other side of the arched passage just beyond the door. Then the kneeling man whispered,
"We're in."
With that, the lookout delivered an urgent whisper into the phone.
"Allez, allez!"
The van began racing forward, closing on 7 Rue Tronchet, as all three men at the door pulled submachine guns from inside their coats. Chapter 5 Court decided he had to get on with it because his legs were cramping, and he had a funny feeling he was going to need to be able to walk, or more likely run, in order to survive the next few minutes. He'd aim for stealth for as long as possible, but he'd be ready to go loud the instant gunfire was required. He pulled his suppressed Glock with his right hand and slowly pushed the linen closet door open with his knee. He climbed out, stood on aching legs, then began sliding slowly to his left, along the farthest edges of the room, moving away from the balcony and away from the bed. His first objective was the door that divided the master bedroom from the rest of the suite. As he inched along the wall in the dark, he kept one eye on the sentry, who was still facing the woman on the bed, slightly away from Court's position here at the man's 9 o'clock. With his other eye, Court kept checking Medina herself to make sure she did not awaken, because her eyes were pointed in his direction. When he arrived at the bedroom door, Court stopped and leaned back against it, still facing the open room. He reached into the cargo pocket on his left leg and pulled a device from it. It was a tack wedge door jammer, a light plastic chalk that could be slid under a door and forced into position, making the door nearly impossible to open from the other side. He knelt down slowly, still checking the two forms across the room, making sure the guard remained outside on the balcony and facing the woman. And the woman was still asleep, or at least unaware there was an armed man in black 40 feet away. As he reached out with the wedge, preparing to make it impossible for the four men in the suite to gain access to their protectee, he was surprised to hear a man shout somewhere downstairs outside the building. It seemed to echo up from the cobblestone forecourt. Court saw the bodyguard on the balcony spin away quickly and rush to the railing to look down. And almost immediately, Court heard the thundering boom of a rifle in the forecourt below. The bodyguard ducked back away from the edge and pulled his weapon from inside his jacket.
What the fuck?
The first gunshot was followed, 1 second later, by a string of automatic gunfire. Court could hear shouts now in the living room of the suite, on the other side of the door behind him, as Bianca's bodyguards became aware of the threat. The American dropped the rest of the way to his knees, held his pistol up towards the balcony, and reached behind him to jam the tack wedge under the door. Then he stood and heel-kicked it hard into place. The sound of his actions was drowned out by an explosion outside that set off car alarms and broke glass all over the neighborhood. As soon as the echoes of the boom died out, another intense volley of fire kicked off. The shouts of men, the rhythmic and repetitive cadence of Allahu Akbar, made it all the way 4 stories up and through the closed balcony doors of the bedroom. Court was surprised that this attack was happening now, but he wasn't surprised it was happening, because he knew something about the threats his target faced. These assholes below were ISIS. They were coming for her at the same time he was, and he'd been assured by his client that they would not hit until tomorrow. Cortland Gentry was a man trained against believing in coincidence, and he had a sinking impression that he had been set up, or at least willfully misinformed about his mission. And this pissed him off. Even in the chaos of this moment, the myriad new and imminent dangers he now faced at his objective, Court still had the presence of mind to tell himself that he was going to beat the living shit out of the people who'd hired him for this operation when this was all over. But first, he had to deal with the woman. At the same instant that Bianca Medina spun out of bed in her warm-ups and sweatshirt, panic-stricken by the gunfire outside, the bodyguard on the balcony flung open the French doors, on his way to put his hands on his protectee and lead her to safety. The man hadn't yet seen Court, but since the American was in the middle of the large room and advancing on the same objective the guard was, Court knew he wasn't going to be invisible for much longer. Behind Court, someone tried to open the bedroom door, then shouted and slammed against it when he found it braced shut. The bodyguard looked up towards the sound, saw Court there in the darkness, and swung his weapon up to fire. Court's weapon was already on target, so he fired first, sending a 9mm hollow-point round across the room and into the Syrian's throat. The bodyguard lurched back with a cry of shock. He grabbed at his wound, but Court shot him again, this time through the solar plexus, and the man fell flat on his back, his arms wide, half inside and half outside the balcony doors. Bianca Medina screamed in utter terror. The sound of the suppressed gunshots had been all but hidden by the thunder of several weapons firing at once in the stone forecourt and the lobby of the property below, so the men slamming their shoulders into the door of the bedroom wouldn't have heard them. But Bianca Medina did hear the noise, and she saw the flash of the weapon held by the masked apparition running at her, just 5 meters from her bed. She dove back onto the king-size bed and rolled over to the other side. Here, she launched off and hoisted the lead crystal decanter that held the brandy, swinging it over her head like a bat. Court himself leapt onto the bed in pursuit of his fleeing target. He holstered his weapon as he did so, and by the time he landed on the other side, both his hands were free.
I'm on your side, Bianca.
She swung the lead crystal decanter at the man in black, but he ducked back and away easily. In French, she shouted,
Take my money! Don't hurt me!
Court closed on her again, and the decanter whipped by his face once more, but this time Court swept it from her hand, knocking it across the bed and onto the floor. Then he took the woman by both wrists and spun her around and up to the wall. Leaning against her body with his own to control her, Court pinned her hands behind her back.
Listen to me. Calm down. I won't hurt you, but everyone else around here will. We need to go, and I'll need your help.
In English, she shouted into the wall.
What is happening?
New gunfire snapped inside the building now. The attackers were clearly making progress on their way up the 2 sets of stairs on opposite sides of the property. For all Court knew, others were in the elevator and could be here on the top floor in seconds. Bianca's bodyguards in the suite banged on the door of the master bedroom and slammed into it with ferocious tenacity, desperate to get to their protectee.
What is happening?
She shouted again. Court said,
You and I are checking out. As for the rest of that racket, my guess is hotel security and your bodyguards are fighting it out with the Islamic State.
She looked back at him, eyes wide.
ISIS? What does ISIS want with me?
Court didn't look at her now. He just spun her around as he held onto her arm. He looked around the room, trying to figure out how the hell to get both himself and the woman to safety. While doing this, he said,
Lady, we both know the answer to that question.
Bianca did know the answer, but Court imagined she had been hoping her rescuer did not. To her credit, Bianca Medina seemed to realize quickly that she was in serious trouble, and this man in black was her only lifeline.
What do you want me to do?
Court looked around the big room. Men banged frantically on the door. Give me a second. With a panic-stricken voice, she said,
You just told me we had to go now!
His original plan had been to use the climbing rope and rappelling equipment stored in his pack to simply hook her onto him with a harness, and then use the harness on his own body to lower them one story down to the balcony below her suite before heading to the hotel stairs to make a stealthy escape through a back exit. But a gun battle of this magnitude raging in central Paris was going to bring a lot of law enforcement, and Court knew he didn't have time to make it down the stairs inside the hotel through security and terrorists before the police arrived and cordoned off the property at ground level. He told himself he needed to somehow get all the way down into the forecourt and out an alleyway to a neighboring property in the next minute or two to have any chance of avoiding getting caught in a massive police cordon. Court could climb down the outside of the building on his own in that amount of time, but he sure as hell couldn't do it while attached to this terrified woman. He looked around the suite a moment more and formulated a hasty plan. His eyes darted to the dead body, then to the door of the room, and then to the balcony railing.
Hey! She shouted. What are we going to?
Court came up with a solution for the equation in front of him. He raced over to the body of the dead Syrian lying on the balcony threshold, grabbed the man by the underarms, then dragged him hurriedly across the hardwood floor, all the way to the door of the suite on the opposite side of the room. A gunfight had begun raging just outside. The men who, seconds earlier, had been banging on the door were now shooting it out with someone near the exterior door to the suite, and no one was trying to get into the bedroom for the time being. Court pulled the end of a spooled climbing rope from his bag, wrapped it under the dead man's body at the underarms, then tied it off quickly and securely with a bowline knot that would tighten the more tension it was put under.
What are you doing?
Medina asked. He stepped up to her now, playing the rope out of the pack and tossing it in coils on the floor as he did so.
I need you to trust me.
I don't trust you at all.
Then fear me, lady. That'll work.
He drew his benchmade infidel. The blade fired out and glowed in the dim moonlight, and with it, he cut the rope where it went into his bag. He took this end and tied it onto a clasp already attached to a single-point nylon and elastic harness, which he also yanked from the bag. Bianca's terror was giving in to confusion.
What is...
Court reached behind Bianca's torso and wrapped the harness under her arms, brought both ends around and above her breast, and fastened them together with the metal locking clasp. She tried to pull away, but he was too strong, too fast, too sure of himself.
Why the fuck are you tying me to Mohammed?
I'm trying to make Mohammed useful.
He turned the woman to the balcony, then pushed her along through the open French doors. Bianca quickly figured out that the man in black wanted her to climb out over the railing to be lowered down, and this stopped her in her tracks.
No!
The gunfire stopped in the suite so suddenly that both Court and Bianca spun back to the new quiet. But Court returned to his work quickly, and soon he tightened his hand on Bianca's shoulder, turning her back around to the railing.
We have to hurry. You'll be fine, I promise. Just close your eyes.
Someone banged on the door now, 50 feet away.
I can't do it!
Court snapped his switchblade closed and threaded the device's belt hook inside the harness around Bianca's torso.
I'm going to lower you down very gently. When you get to the ground, cut yourself loose. Find cover behind one of the stone planters in the forecourt. I'll free climb down. Wait for me.
No, I cannot. I'm scared.
Court lifted the woman off the ground now, cradling her in his arms. He jerked his head towards the door to the suite.
Whatever is about to come through that door will be a lot scarier than this.
Court's plan was to use the dead guard as a counterweight and the friction of the body along the 50 feet of travertine bedroom floor and stone balcony tile as a means to control Bianca's descent more easily than lowering her himself. Since the dead bodyguard weighed more than the Spanish fashion model, Court knew he would have to assist her descent by pulling the rope along. But this would be easier and faster for him than slowly lowering the 110-pound woman four floors down to the cobblestones. Court stepped up to the balcony railing, and the woman squeezed her eyes shut.
Please, monsieur, I just...
I'll be gentle and I'll go as slow as I can. It will be a nice, smooth ride as long as you...
An explosion behind caused them both to spin their heads around again. The door to the living room had been blown in with some sort of charge, and debris tore through the room. As the two on the balcony watched, a pair of figures began rushing into the bedroom through the smoke and dust, Behind them in the living room, three more apparitions appeared. All the men held weapons and wore black tactical gear, and they seemed to float around in the haze like danger itself. Court stood with Bianca 50 feet away, directly in the line of fire of 5 submachine guns. The gray man whirled back away from the danger, and with all the momentum of his spin, he heaved the woman over the balcony railing, throwing her out into the night air. Court spun back and drew his Glock, while behind him, Bianca Medina screamed as she dropped like a stone. Chapter 6. The slack rope tightened, and in the bedroom by the shattered living room door, the body of the Syrian guard lurched and began rocketing across the tavernine floor, many times faster than Court had planned. Court knew his only option had been to toss the girl and engage the attackers. But he also knew that throwing her over the side like that was going to give her too much momentum, more than enough to send her to her death if he couldn't arrest her descent before she hit the hard stone tiles of the forecourt. But he couldn't even address that problem yet. The first burst of incoming rounds screamed high over Court's head, and he raced forward on the balcony, then dove head first, launching himself to the right of the French doors, rolling on his right shoulder under the spraying gunfire and up onto his knee pads in a firing stance. He came to a stop upright, still in view of the enemy through the side light next to the doors. His Glock was out in front of him, his front sight lining up on a target, a man moving laterally in the bedroom from right to left, trying to get his own sight picture on Court. But the American saw the terrorist first, aimed his weapon first, and fired first, and he hit the man just under the right collarbone. A second shot sparked off the man's MP5 rifle, ricocheted up into his face, and sent him tumbling back against the far wall of the bedroom and down to the floor, covering his eyes and screaming. Court felt the compression in the air from a shrieking round missing the left side of his head by less than a foot, and he saw the muzzle flash ahead, pinpointing his target kneeling near the linen closet, still obscured by smoke and darkness in the recesses of the bedroom. Court fired a string of 4 rounds in his target's direction, over the dead man tied to Bianca and sliding along face down on the floor. Behind Court on his left, the rope whined and burned as it ran over the iron railing. He knew if he grabbed the thin rope with his bare hands, it would rip his hands to shreds, and Bianca would continue falling too fast to survive the impact. And even if he grabbed the corpse as it passed, he would probably dislocate an arm and still fail to stop Medina from hitting the cobblestones hard. His only chance to prevent Bianca's impact with the ground was to dive flat on top of the dead body counterweight before she hit. Court fired 3 more rounds through the sidelight again, towards the doorway to the living room, then rolled out from behind concealment, launching himself to the left with all the power in his legs. He landed on the bodyguard 15 feet from the railing, then went flat, emptying his Glock at the terrorists in the doorway as he glided along on top of the corpse. He stopped just 6 feet from the edge of the balcony as his pistol locked open. Bianca would be dangling just a few feet off the alley pavement now, if Court's calculations had been correct. But if he had made an error in his math, then she would probably be lying dead on the cobblestones of the forecourt behind and below him. A massive, sustained volley of gunfire erupted now, and the balcony was riddled with lead. Court rolled off the body, then again went to his right, outside the view of the shooters, but not out of danger, as their bullets threatened to rip apart the stone masonry of the outer wall of the bedroom. All around him on the balcony, planters cracked and spilled their contents, glass shattered, and bullets ricocheted up into the night with a high-pitched whine. This was not a sustainable fight for him, Court knew. But he also knew he could not simply climb down the outside of the building without these men making their way to the balcony and easily picking off Medina as she hung there by the rope. Either he had to defeat the attackers up here totally, or else he had to find a faster way down to the forecourt. As he reloaded while lying flat on the balcony tile, an idea came to him. He fired 6 more 9mm rounds to keep the heads of the men in the living room down, then reached for his vest and pulled a device from it with his left hand. It was a 9-banger flashbang grenade, and Court pulled the ring and sidearmed the small can towards the enemy at the door. After just 1 second, while it was still in the air, soaring across the bedroom, the 9-banger began to detonate, and intense white bursts and extremely loud reports erupted. But the device continued to sail on, hitting the travertine floor at the doorway and bouncing into the living room, right in the middle of the men there. 9 flashes and booms in all blasted from the device, and while it was still going off, stunning and blinding everyone in the area, Cort unfastened a second canister from his belt. This was a single detonation stun grenade. He pulled both rings and slung it towards the threats in the living room. This one did not arc as high. It bounced along and then slid across the bedroom, but right at the doorway it, too, detonated, delivering an explosion of 180 decibels, 30 decibels louder than a jet engine on takeoff. It gave off a burst of light rated at 1 million candelas, enough to cause flash blindness to anyone within close proximity. Even before the device went off, Cort was up off the balcony tile and running forward towards the danger as fast as he could. His eyes closed and face averted from the light, and his brain anticipating the boom that would take the others by stunned surprise. He crossed the bedroom in less than 3 seconds, leapt through the air, landed and slid on his hip along the travertine floor through the doorway into the living room. Here, he found himself in the midst of 3 utterly stunned attackers. None of the men could see or hear, and Cort's plan had been to simply shoot each man with his suppressed Glock and end the threat completely. But just as he skidded to a stop on his back and leveled his weapon at the first dazed terrorist, gunfire cracked from the doorway between the big suite and the hallway that led to the stairs. Multiple flashes of light erupted, and Cort realized there was at least one more gunman in the hall engaging him. Cort shifted his aim to the doorway, spreading his legs and pointing his weapon down between his feet, and fired his Glock until it emptied again, sending the shooter or shooters there to cover and buying himself an instant of mobility. He didn't have time to reload the pistol and shoot the 3 men on their knees around him, so he slapped his empty weapon back into the polymer holster and reached into his pack with one hand to grab the second rope line that he stored there, while using his other hand to take hold of the ammo vest worn by the closest terrorist. Cort yanked the man to him, hooked the carabiner on the end of the line to the man's vest, then leapt to his feet and started back for the bedroom in a low sprint. He'd made it just a couple of steps before booming gunfire from the hallway behind him began again, and just 2 more steps before he reached the other 2 men there at the doorway. Both were still down on their hands and knees, only now beginning to fight their way out of the several seconds long disorientation brought on by the 2 grenades. As Cort passed the second man, he saw that the terrorist had a baseball-sized M67 hand grenade hooked in a pouch on his vest. Cort reached out as he ran by, jammed his thumb inside the pull ring, and pressed on the safety lever with his hand. He raced on, yanking the pull ring along with him. The still dazed man recognized what had just happened, but his reaction was slowed by his concussion and his double vision. He just climbed up to his feet and reached out weakly towards the man rushing by, as if to stop him. Cort kept running, even faster now, letting the ring drop to the floor of the bedroom as rope spooled out from his backpack behind him. A round from an MP5 slammed into the bedpost ahead of him on his left, splintering the hand-carved finial, but all Cort could do was shift a little to the right, duck lower, and run faster. And worry, because there was much to worry about just now. He knew he could be shot dead before he made it off the balcony, and he knew that if the man with the line hooked to his vest came to his senses and unfastened the carabiner, in the next 3 or 4 seconds, Cort would plummet to his death. Similarly, he understood that if the guy with the grenade on his chest got his shit together and threw the device Cort's way, he'd be riddled with steel shot before he even got over the railing. He shifted back to his left as more rounds slammed the French door ahead on the right, and he listened to the sound of the Kevlar line that was quickly playing out of its spool in his pack. He knew he didn't have enough length to get him to the ground, but the other end exited his pack at the bottom and connected to the body harness under his clothing, and the line was, at least, long enough to get him down a couple of floors. Cort dove headfirst over the balcony railing. Behind him, the man on the other end of the Kevlar line had been in the process of trying to get his vest off, but just as he unhooked the first plastic buckle, he launched forward, landed on his knees, fell onto his face, and began sliding towards the doorway, closing on the terrorist with the live frag grenade on his assault vest. This man himself recognized the danger he was in, and he was in the process of frantically trying to get the grenade off his body. The grenade detonated, killing the man wearing it, plus another ISIS gunman, and wounding the stunned attacker tethered to Cort, along with a 4th ISIS fighter who had entered the living room from the hallway. And the wounded man on the line slid on towards the balcony. Chapter 7. Court dropped two stories before his harness grabbed him around the crotch and the waist, and then he slowed as the human counterweight in the living room began jolting and sliding across the floor. When the man got caught on the wreckage of the French door, Court stopped completely, still far above the forecourt. He knew it would be faster to cut away the rope than to remove the harness under his clothing, so he pulled his boot knife, took a firm hold of the balcony next to him, and cut his own lifeline away. Court climbed down the rest of the way, using the line attached to Bianca and his feet pushing along the balconies of the lower floor suites to help him descend. As soon as he made it down to the forecourt, he saw Bianca, only a few yards from him and facing away. She had managed to cut herself free of the rope, and now she just stood there in shock, unable to run for cover.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, taking her by the arm and removing the switchblade from her hand. As he spoke, he started to lead her out of the line of fire of anyone in the front lobby or above in her suite. She spun around and punched Court in the chest. He took the blow, and then a second, but he caught her third swing. He yanked her now, pulling her roughly across the forecourt.
"You fucker!" she screamed.
Court looked back up to the balcony, then again at the woman. He pulled her into a side alleyway that led through a neighboring courtyard.
"Believe me, I get it."
Still holding her close, he ran with her through the courtyard, but since she was barefoot and the light was bad, they did not run fast. Court carried a tactical light, but didn't want to use it to avoid the risk of being sighted by any high-stepping police who had managed to make it to the scene in the first couple minutes of the action. He had a car waiting for him on the street that ran along the square Louis XVI, three blocks northwest of the hotel, and by the time they made it there, the night was filled with sirens and squealing tires. He checked her eyes as he put her in the car, and he thought she was suffering from shock, but she spoke clearly as he climbed into the driver's seat.
"Where are we going?"
Court didn't answer. He just started the dark blue four-door and took off towards the north. A minute later, she tried again. Through the tears that came inevitably after the stress and turmoil of the previous 5 minutes, she said,
"Monsieur, where are we?"
"Seatbelt."
"What?"
"Put on your seatbelt, safety first."
"Are you joking?"
He did not answer. So she did as she was told, fumbling the easy task for several seconds because of her shaking hands. When the lock clicked into place, she sniffed unglamorously.
"Monsieur, will you please take me to Charles de Gaulle Airport? I have a flight this afternoon, but I can try to get an earlier..."
He interrupted her.
"I'm taking you somewhere safe. You have friends in the city, people who will help you."
"Friends? From Zuhair Murat?"
Court turned to her as he drove, then looked away.
"No, lady. You were not rescued from ISIS terrorists by a dressmaker."
"Who are these friends, then?"
The man in black pulled his phone from his pocket and tapped a button, placing a call. Bianca looked up to him, obviously hoping to learn something from his conversation about what the fuck was happening all around her. But after a 10-second wait, the man simply said,
"En route. 15 minutes."
On the way, 15 minutes. This told her next to nothing other than the fact that, just as he had said, there were others involved in all this. She wiped tears from her eyes with the sleeve of her sweatshirt now.
"Listen, I need you to tell me..."
Court turned to her.
"Look straight ahead, out the window, not at me, and stop talking. You're out of danger for now. That is all you need to know."
Court could tell Bianca did not want to comply, but he could also tell she was scared. Not just scared because of what she had just survived, but scared of Court himself. Bianca Medina knew dangerous men, and she would recognize that Court remained a threat to her. Bianca looked down at the dashboard for nearly a minute before she said,
"Thank you, monsieur."
Court turned to her again, suddenly, startling her anew.
"Don't thank me. I didn't do it because I like you. I did it because it was my job. Like I said, I know who you really are."
Bianca just stared ahead. After several sobs, she got control over her emotions.
"If you know who I really am, then you also know you are in a lot of trouble right now. Many people will come after you, even here in Paris."
The man continued looking ahead.
"Lady, I really wish they would try."
They drove along back streets until they reached the commune of Saint-Ouen in the Seine-Saint-Denis district, some 4 miles north of the action on the Rue Tronchet. The neighborhood was full of immigrants, mostly from North Africa and the Middle East, and in the last few years, there had been a massive influx of Syrian refugees. It had little charm of the city center, more poverty, more crime. Saint-Ouen was also home of the Paris flea market, the largest concentration of second-hand furniture dealers on Earth. Throughout a dozen massive buildings, the market was open several days a week and brought in buyers from all over the world. Court's vehicle was one of only a very few on the road this time of the morning as he turned onto the Rue Marie Curie, and his headlights provided the only illumination when he navigated down a tight alley running off it. Soon, he turned through the open gate of a tiny parking lot that ran between two darkened warehouses full of unrestored antique furniture. The gate was pulled closed behind him by a man whom Court could just barely make out in the darkness, and then Court parked the car and turned off the ignition. He went around the front of the vehicle, helped Bianca out, put a hand on her arm, and guided her through the misty artificial light of the parking lot. No one was watching. But if any spectators had been around, his actions would have appeared chivalrous. Nevertheless, he was certain the young model could feel the frostiness in his grip because he pulled her along more roughly than he had back at the hotel on the Rue Tronchet. Out here, alone, there was no longer any question of the woman's compliance. She had overcome her shock, but she wasn't yet in a frame of mind to put up much resistance to what was going on. She'd do as he said, and she'd go where he pulled her. Court led Bianca by the elbow through an open door in a warehouse and into a circular stairwell. Halfway up, he saw a bearded man lean around from his position at the top of the stairs looking down. Court drew his pistol and pointed it at the man's head. Bianca shrieked with alarm. Quickly, the man raised his empty hands. Court continued climbing, keeping the barrel of his weapon pointed at the man's face.
"Are you armed?" Court asked in French.
The man pointed down to his waistband. Court let go of Bianca, shifted his pistol to his left hand, then frisked the man with his right. He pulled out a checkmate handgun, ejected the magazine, and cleared the round in the chamber, racking the slide one-handed by striking the rear sight on his belt. The cartridge bounced down the stairs, and then Court tossed the weapon down behind it and listened to it clank along the steps as it fell. Court turned the man towards the door and pushed him onwards.
"Open it."
The bearded man did as instructed, and Court escorted both Bianca and the security man inside. Court found himself in a small but well-appointed apartment full of crackling firelight. This space had been built in the 1950s for a wealthy antiques dealer, and the furnishings and feel were a striking departure from the simple masonry warehouse facade of the building. The fireplace warmed the living room, and a middle-aged woman in a sweater and slacks sat in front of it. Two young men wearing black jackets and jeans leaned on the wall by the draped windows, and an older man stood by the fire, his hand propped on the ornate mantel as if he were posing for a photo. The middle-aged woman had attractive red hair and olive skin. She was clearly Middle Eastern. And the man standing at the fireplace, Court saw, was Dr. Tarek Halabi, the man he'd met in the cemetery that morning. When Court saw Halabi, he said,
"This clown was in the stairwell. My instructions were clear to the Frenchman I spoke with on the phone. I didn't want any armed men in my way when I arrived."
"I apologize for the miscommunication. This man is with us."
Court holstered his weapon,
and I almost turned his head into a canoe. "You guys can't follow instructions?"
Halabi started to answer, but Bianca spoke up now, in English, to the middle-aged couple by the fire.
"Who are you people? I don't know you."
The red-headed woman stood. Her manners were gentle and stately, and there was a calm smile on her face that belied the situation. She answered Bianca in Arabic.
"If you will follow me, daughter, all will be explained. We have tea prepared, some clothes for you to change into, and a private place for us to sit and talk a while."
Bianca did not reply at first, and when she finally did, she said,
"Speak English, French, or Spanish, or don't talk to me at all.
The redhead furrowed her eyebrows, then repeated herself in effortless English. Bianca said,
I want you to tell me what is going on right now.
The woman by the fireplace smiled.
My name is Rima Halabi. This is my husband, Tarek Halabi.
Medina shrugged.
These names mean nothing to me. We are both medical doctors, surgeons, living here in Paris.
And?
And we are Syrian exiles.
Bianca Medina blinked, swallowed. After a moment's hesitation, she furrowed her thin eyebrows.
So?
Rima smiled at her like she was dealing with a petulant child.
As I said, come this way. I will answer all your questions.
The raven-haired Spanish woman was a quarter century younger and nearly a full head taller than the redhead. Rima put a gentle hand on Bianca's arm and turned to usher her down a hallway that led to the rear of the apartment. The man Court had pushed into the room had moved to a position between the windows, but he took a step forward now, as if to shepherd the model along if she did not comply. But Bianca didn't need the hint. Without further protest, she followed the redhead. Bianca looked back over her shoulder to the American as she did so, but said nothing. And soon, she disappeared in the darkness behind the older woman. The bearded guard followed behind them, along with one of the other men who'd been standing near the windows. Court could see the print of a pistol on the man's hip under his jacket. The other man by the window, Court imagined he was armed as well, just receded back against the wall, looking on. Court took these men for security. Court knew what this organization was up against, and a few guys with guns loitering around this safe house didn't seem like much of a defensive setup. He shook his head in disgust, and he glared at Tarek Halabi. Chapter 8. The doctor standing by the fireplace surveyed the American he'd hired for tonight's work. The asset had some scratches on his face, but more notable than the superficial wounds was the man's unmistakable anger. And Halabi was sure he knew why. Tarek's wife, Rima, had warned him against dealing in person with this dangerous man, and Rima, as usual, had been right. But Tarek had insisted on interacting directly with the asset. Now Halabi could not help but wish the Frenchman who'd connected him with the American operator were here, in his shoes, instead of waiting in the back room of this apartment. It had been the Frenchman's idea that he remain hidden from the asset. Tarek assumed the man had his reasons because the Frenchman had experience in these matters, and he clearly knew what he was doing. Halabi waited to hear the door close down the hall before addressing his new guest.
We are monitoring police channels. Through them we understand Daesh chose tonight to come for Mademoiselle Medina. Of course, we were aware they had an operation planned against her, as we informed you. But our intelligence indicated it would happen tomorrow when she was on the way to the airport.
He motioned to the chairs in front of the fireplace, but when the American did not move to sit, Halabi decided to remain standing next to the mantel. The American replied,
Yeah, that's what you told me. I am truly sorry. We were going on information we received from...
You said four gunners, five, maybe.
Correct. That's what I was told. How many did you encounter?
Seven, minimum. Could have been more.
Halabi considered this, then said,
We knew she would be a prime target for them, but this Islamic State cell was from Brussels, and we did not know for sure how many would come to Paris. I'm sorry, the numbers were off from what we expected.
You wanted that woman's help, and you wanted to save her life so she'd be more inclined to give you the help. The ISIS hitters showed up right when I was making my move, so I'd say everything worked out in your favor tonight.
With an angry glare, the American added,
I guess that just makes you one lucky son of a bitch.
Tarek Halabi heard the sarcasm, and he saw the irritation, but he had no reply that would convince the American operative that he had not misled him. So he changed the subject.
Did anyone see you?
The man seemed to take a few breaths to control his rage, then replied,
No one who is around to talk about it. I avoided hotel cameras. The car is clean.
He looked around at the room, but still. A little free advice, because you guys look like you could use it. Do your organization a favor. Consider this safe house burned.
Move your operation as soon as you can. Triple your security, even if you have to hire goons paid by the hour.
I'll take your suggestion under advisement.
The American rolled his eyes. Or die, it's up to you. Seriously, dude, this isn't Band-Aids and biscuits anymore. You do realize you guys are fighting a war, don't you?
We are not soldiers. My wife and I, we are doctors, healers. We spent the first 6 years of the war raising relief supplies. Twice a year, we would go over the Turkish border into northern Syria with our son and daughter, also doctors, to run health clinics, to perform surgery on wounded civilians. We are not violent people, but we have been forced into a life we did not choose to lead. Actions we are not comfortable with, because we know our nation requires...
Skip it. Forget I asked.
After a time, Halabi said, Nevertheless, despite the difficulties tonight, you did exactly as you were told.
Thank you.
The American moved towards the door. I wanted to help, but now... This is just business. You will transfer the rest of the money into my account by dawn or I'll come looking for you.
He looked at his watch. You have 3.5 hours.
It will be done well within your time frame, of course.
The American turned for the door again, but Halabi called out to him.
Monsieur, I know you are angry, but remember, we have resources, donations from all over the world. A man of your skills, of your discretion, there might be more work for you in the future, opportunities on the horizon involving our struggle.
You had one chance to show me how you operate. You kept the key information from me, and you almost got me killed.
He opened the door. You guys are on your own.
Tara Kalabi watched the asset leave without another word.
She's in the bathroom throwing up,
Rima Halabi said as she entered the living room, startling her husband, who was still facing the door and thinking about what the American had said. Tarek was embarrassed to be caught in a moment of self-doubt and reflection. He said,
To be expected. We'll give her a few minutes, but we won't have much time to make this work.
Rima herself looked to the doorway now.
The American. Any problems?
He's furious. He thinks we knew Daesh was coming tonight.
Then he's crazy. Why would we lie about the danger? Our entire operation depended on the survival of Bianca Medina.
Yes, but the information about Daesh attacking wasn't our intelligence. It was intelligence we were given.
Do you think it's possible we're being manipulated in all this? By whom?
Tarek turned to his wife.
Who do you think?
You're talking about Monsieur Voland?
Rima looked back to the dark hallway, in the direction of the bedroom.
Of course not. Voland is on our side. He has led us this far. In fact, with the exception of that American who is a simple mercenary, everyone working with us has the same objective.
I don't know, Tarek said. The Americans seem to care about our cause for some reason.
She took her husband by the hand.
He cares about 1.2 million euros. Come, enough talk of our shadow men. Let's move on to the next stage of our operation.
Tarek and Rima Halabi entered the back bedroom suite just as the Spanish model stepped out of the bathroom. Bianca had let her hair down, and she was now dressed in clothes Rima had bought for her earlier in the day. Dark jeans, a brown cashmere sweater, simple flats. She sat down at a small wooden table across from the Syrian couple, giving off no hint she'd been vomiting just minutes before. She had stopped shaking, her back was straight, her hands were folded on the table in front of her, and she appeared as if she had come for a job interview. A young man with a submachine gun hanging off his shoulder sat on the windowsill and looked down to the misty parking lot below, and another man, small and thin and wearing a dark blue suit, sat in a leather wingback chair in the corner. He had wavy, silver hair, but his face was enshrouded in darkness, because he positioned himself outside the spare lamplight in the room. Rima Halabi spoke first.
You are certain you are not hurt, daughter?
Instead of answering, Bianca motioned to the man in the blue suit.
And who is that, there in the shadows?
He is a friend, Rima replied.
Bianca looked at the man for a while, then turned back to the Halabis.
Tell me what happened tonight.
Rima said,
A cell of terrorists from the Islamic State tried to kill you. My organization has prevented this, and we delivered you here, to safety.
What organization?
Bianca asked. Now Tarek spoke. Let's begin with you. You are Bianca Medina, daughter of Alex Medina, a hotelier in Barcelona.
And for that I have been attacked by Daesh and kidnapped by you?
We rescued you. We did not kidnap you, Bianca said.
I'm starting to wonder about that. Your father, Rima said, Alex Medina of Barcelona. He was born Ali Medina of Damascus, was he not?
Medina lifted her chin a little.
And if he was, is that a crime?
No crime, Rima said. I'm just establishing your familial connection to Syria. I'll come back to it. You are 26 years old. You began modeling at 13. You must have been very good at it because you were traveling the world within a year, living between Barcelona, New York, and here in Paris.
You read old magazines, I see.
Rima went on. At age 24, during the height of your fame and success, you were invited to Damascus to attend a party honoring your grandfather, a construction industry giant in the nation and closely tied to the government in power. There you met Shakira Azam, the first lady of Syria. The two of you became close friends. Before long, you were invited to the palace for a party, and via this invitation, you met Ahmed Azam, the president of Syria.
That's ridiculous. I barely knew Shakira, through European friends in the fashion industry. And I've never met...
Tarek leaned over the table now. There is no use in lying to us. You are here tonight because of your own actions. You are here for the same reason Daesh targeted you.
And what reason is that?
You are the lover, pardon my indelicacy, the mistress of Ahmed Al-Azam, the president of Syria. And this means you are having an affair with the most horrible man in the world. Bianca felt the muscles in her face quiver uncontrollably, so she turned away from her interrogators and looked to the wall in the room until she felt she could regain enough manufactured poise to face them. Eventually, she turned back and looked into the woman's eyes. She chose the redhead as the target of her attention because she was softer than her husband, both in nature and in disposition. But Bianca Medina had no illusions that this woman would be kind to her. Medina constructed her facial expression to convey what she wanted it to convey, to play a role, just as if she were performing for a camera's lens. She hid her emotions and insecurity and projected a practiced air of confidence, something she had learned from many years of modeling. She was an expert at hiding who she was, of masking what she felt.
You two are insane. I am no one's mistress.
And just like the camera lens, Rima Halabi did not blink. She said,
We know everything, daughter. You will only waste time denying what we know to be true.
She put a hand out and rested it on Medina's folded hands gently.
But don't worry. No one here is judging you for your decisions.
All right, Bianca said, and she pulled her hands a few inches closer to her, out from under Rima's.
I have been living in Damascus, but that is only because my father has a home there. I needed to get away from Paris and New York. I wanted to return to my roots, to my heritage. There is no law against living in Syria with a Spanish passport. In fact, I also have a flat in Barcelona and an apartment in Brooklyn. But I have no relationship with Ahmed Azam.
Rima surprised Bianca by reaching again for her hands, taking them in hers and pulling them closer.
Listen to me, daughter. The information about your affair with Ahmed came from a well-placed source inside Syria, someone who, frankly, knows everything about you and what's been going on.
Bianca forced a laugh.
A source? Who is this supposed source?
Tarek leaned forward now. With a solemn tone, he said, The First Lady of Syria, Shakira Azam. There was no more posturing for Bianca, no more contrived poise. The color drained from her face, her eyes widened, and the muscles in her neck fluttered. She muttered a hoarse reply.
What?
Rima nodded solemnly.
It's true. Intelligence officials here in France intercepted a message out of Damascus to an ISIS operations commander in Belgium. It came from someone close to Shakira. The message mentioned that you would soon be taking a 3-night trip to Paris to participate in Fashion Week, and it identified you as the mistress of the Emir of Kuwait, who is a sworn enemy of ISIS. This is not true, of course. We assume Shakira wanted you targeted. But she did not want it made public that her husband was a philanderer. We have contacts in Syria, however, and they did some further digging on you. They determined you were the lover of Ahmed Azam. Rima smiled sympathetically now. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but it seems Shakira was trying very hard to entice the Islamic State to murder you for sleeping with her husband. Bianca spun out of her chair and raced back into the bathroom. She slammed the door behind her, and the Halabis listened to her vomit again into the sink. Chapter 9. The new Shab presidential palace in Damascus sits on Mount Meza, overlooking the Syrian capital, where the ultra-modern cubist complex looks more like a high-tech fortress from a science fiction film than any presidential residence. At 5.5 million square feet and constructed largely out of Carrara marble, it is a gargantuan display of dictatorial excess for everyone in Damascus to see, simply by looking up and to the west. The new Shab had been built in the mid-70s, designed by a Japanese architect for Jamal al-Azam, the father of the present leader of Syria. But Jamal never lived in the monstrosity himself. He deemed the palace too big and ostentatious for one family. And for the first dozen years of his son Ahmed's rule, Ahmed Azam agreed. Before the war came to the city, the Azam family had lived in a modern but relatively nondescript home in a residential district of the Meza municipality, west of the city center. But when bombings, assassinations, and kidnappings kicked off in the capital city itself, the pretentious citadel on the hill became the only safe place for the Azams. Ahmed fortified the complex with his most trusted guards, police, and intelligence officials, and he moved himself and his family inside. The first family of Syria lives in a 30-room guest house on the northern edge of the property, officially speaking, but Ahmed Azam almost always spends the night in an apartment in his suite of offices a quarter mile away from his family in the palace proper. His wife also has an office suite at her disposal on the other side of the palace grounds, but with young children, she finds herself with the kids most nights in the guest house. But not this night. This night, the 47-year-old First Lady sat alone in a plush salon in her private apartment. At 3 a.m., she wore a sweater and a pair of designer jeans. Her dyed blonde hair was pinned up, and she sat on a white leather sofa with her legs curled under her. She watched Al Jazeera World News with the volume low, and a satellite phone rested next to her. She'd been like this for the past 2 hours. Her half-dozen personal assistants had been sent away for the night, so they were all back in their palace apartments, but they also knew they needed to keep their phones on. All 6 of them remained on call for the summons of what often happened when Shakira was up late and scheming. She might want food, she might want information. She might want someone to drive over and personally check on the nannies of the children to make sure they were watching over her 2 teenage daughters, Aliyah and Kalila. And if this happened, any one of her assistants would climb out of bed and do her bidding without hesitation, because the mercurial Shakira al-Azam commanded just as much respect and fear among the staff as the president of Syria himself. Shakira had not been raised to live in a palace. Born in London to Syrian parents, she had grown up in an upper-middle-class Western childhood. She studied business and graduated from the London School of Economics before taking a job at a bank in Switzerland. She worked hard and enjoyed the life of a successful young Western European. But on a trip home to London, she met Ahmed al-Azam, then a fledgling orthopedic resident working at a clinic in Fulham. The two young and good-looking Syrians fell for each other quickly, and they were married within a year, and just a year after that, they were forced to return to Syria when Ahmed's father died of liver disease. Ahmed had had no desire to lead Syria,
but his older brother, the real heir apparent, had died in a car crash in Damascus, and the Al-Azam family would not relinquish the power over the nation that Jamal Azam had fought so hard to acquire and maintain. For Shakira's part, she'd had no aspirations to be First Lady, but just like her husband,